on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard another edition of The Big Fish for this Easter long weekend, a time when people usually turn to catching a few fish for a feed. It's a great fishing time, although we've had the big wet and a lot of rivers are out of action, a lot of pollution in some of the waterways, including the Hawkesbury and some of those beaches around the Central Coast, but for other areas it could be okay. A great story to kick out this morning, our first cast, fisheries scientist Luke Pearce, who's been involved in a wonderful project to bring back the Macquarie perch. Now, the Macquarie perch is extinct, or was extinct, in the river that it gets its name from. But not anymore. We'll explain next. Good morning, Luke Pearce.
Morning, Scotty.
Luke, this is an incredible story, isn't it? This fish, the Macquarie perch, that you love so much and could really be one of the great angling species of the future, if we can bring it back from the brink of extinction, has, well, it's symbolic, isn't it? It's come back to the river where Europeans first identified it, the river that it took its name from.
Yeah, it is, Scotty. And how fitting is it that we're talking about the second coming of Macquarie perch on Easter Saturday? They're back. They're back from the dead. They're back in the Macquarie catchment. It's a really exciting story, and it's a really exciting project that to be involved with them. And it's just incredible that we've actually been able to do it, I think. And I'll give you the timeline, Scotty, around this. You know, Macquarie perch were first identified by a French naturalist called René Lesson back in February of 1824. About 197 years ago, and after about 127, 130 years of European settlement in Australia, we'd wiped them out from that catchment. They've been gone from the Macquarie catchment for over 70 years, and you know, it's quite historic and symbolic that we've now been able to bring them back. So we've released 7,500 Macquarie perch back into the catchment, and only about 20 kilometres from where that first individual was captured back in 1824. So it's just incredible.
This is almost like bringing back the Tasmanian tiger or the thylacine, isn't it? It's an amazing story, this whole idea that these fish can be bred, as we saw with the trout cod and the eastern cod and the Murray cod that were also doing it very tough. Silver perch in the hatcheries, you can breed them up, but not so with the Macquarie perch up until now. Why was that?
Yeah, Macquarie perch have long been difficult to breed in captivity. You know, we've been trying since scientists and fisheries people have been trying since the early 1950s to breed Macquarie perch in captivity with very limited success. And, you know, the stumbling block has been getting female Macquarie perch to produce eggs and go into that spawning mode within that captive environment. Essentially, there's been some work where, you know, they've relied on running ripe fish collected from the wild and taken back to the hatchery, and that's produced some fish in the past. But, you know, that closed cycle, that closed loop within the hatchery has eluded us to date. And you know, we've made some really significant progress in that space recently with a really amazing collaborative project with the Sunshine Coast University from up north of Brisbane. You know, the team of Abigail and the team up there have been developing a species-specific hormone for Macquarie perch. It's technology that was developed for the aquaculture industry to produce things like southern bluefin tuna and kingfish and even things like sea cucumber commercially. And they've taken that technology and that approach across and developed a species-specific hormone for Macquarie perch, which they used along with our scientists for the first time in the spawning season of last year, in October last year. And much to our, you know, delight and amazement, you know, it was really successful. You know, virtually all of the fish that we administered this hormone to either spawned simultaneously in the tanks, in the hatchery, or within that artificial stream that we've talked about before in the ponds back at our Narendra Fishery Centre. So, had amazing success. You know, it's not perfected the technique by any chance, but you know, this is a really significant step forward in the closed loop captive production of this species. And it's kind of like a jigsaw, though. I like to liken it to a jigsaw puzzle. You know, we've been trying to put the pieces of this jigsaw puzzle together for a long time, and you know, we've had one critical piece missing, you know, that really hard bit to find in the jigsaw puzzle that we just can't find. And And I think we've now, you know, locked that piece in, and you know, the rest from here on will be relatively easy when you go relatively easier once, you know, once you get to the end of that jigsaw puzzle, the rest of the pieces kind of just fall into place. And I think we can really, really make some major steps forward now in the production of this species long term.
And Luke, you mentioned there that they were harvesting ripe fish, and there's a wonderful ABC historical newsreel video that's you actually, I think, made available on YouTube, or someone made available on YouTube, that shows exactly what you're talking about. It was a very difficult task, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was, and we'll put a link to that video up in the notes of the show if you can, Scotty. It's an amazing footage, and there's a couple of really critical things to take away from that footage. So that's from the late 1950s, and it's the Victorian fisheries people down collecting running ripe Macquarie perch from the Jamison River and spawning
them on
the
riverbank. So running ripe, you say. What do you mean by running ripe?
So they're basically about to spawn in the wild. So their eggs are ready to... They're basically ready to lay their eggs, and the males are ready to
fertilize like the amazing footage we see from Alaska or Canada of the salmon running upstream to spawn. This is a similar sort of migration, is it?
Exactly the same. Exactly the same. These fish were running up out of the Jemison Weir into the Jemison River to spawn, and the fishery scientists were collecting them, and then they would harvest the eggs and the sperm from those fish and fertilize them on the riverbank. And back then they were actually sending them out to the farmers to populate their farm dams. And there's a couple of really critical things about that video. Is one, just the size and depth of these fish. They're really big fish. People don't have an appreciation for actually how big Macquarie perch can grow. These things are like 40 centimetres long and you know, 5 or 6 pounds. They're really substantial fish.
And they're in crystal clear water.
Crystal clear water.
You know, this is a fish that would beat the socks off any trout. They're not that we're maligning trout. I mean, they coexist. But these things will rise. They'll take a nymph. They'll take a bait. They'll take a lure. They're incredible table fish. They're incredible fighting fish. And they live in that beautiful environment where you can sight fish to them and see them come up and rise as you've done in collecting them, of course. You can't target them. But, you know, this could be the saviour of fly fishing as well in our alpine streams as trout disappear due to the climate change.
Yeah, for sure. I think they're a really viable proposition for a lot of those waters that are now marginal for trout. If we can upscale this production and start to produce them in bigger numbers and get them re-established back in some of those areas where they would have been historically. And the interesting thing about that footage is, you know, up until, you know, very recently, we hadn't advanced at all in the production of this species. You know, our production, and particularly the production in Victoria, was reliant on these fish running up out of natural systems in the wild.
So that's very dangerous, isn't it? If something happens to their habitat, we had the big fire events with those blackwater events and all that. These fish were teetering on the brink, but if you can work it out in the hatchery, then they can be saved. Talk about trout cod. I mean, they can produce those by the tens of thousands in the hatchery now, can't they?
They sure can, yeah. And certainly, you know, particularly for trout cod, you know, that's been, a real success story in captive breeding and reintroduction. You know, trout cod were almost gone. They were on the brink of extinction. There was one wild population left in the entire world. And now, you know, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, but there's over a dozen re-established populations of that species across New South Wales, Victoria, from one, you know, back in the late 80s. They were almost gone. We almost lost that incredible fish. And Macquarie perch are in a very similar predicament. You know, we've got more than one population left, but all of those populations are really small. They're isolated. The genetic diversity is really low, and they're at real risk of, you know, things like drought, things like fire, as you said. You know, we can lose those populations, and we may well have lost one population in New South Wales from those black summer bushfires. We haven't detected, you know, Macquarie perch in that Manus Creek system that we've talked about before since those black summer fires. So we may well have lost that population in New South Wales. And that means that we now only potentially have three wild populations of Macquarie perch left in New South Wales.
Had you taken any fish out of Manus before that event to keep for possible breeding purposes?
We sure did.
That's good for genetic diversity, is it?
Yeah. So we only managed to collect 10 individuals after the fires. We went in there, we first went in there 3 days after the fire went through, I think, and we worked really hard to try and catch fish, but there just wasn't many there. It was a pretty devastated environment. And we actually went back the following week with more people and more resources to try and collect more fish. But unfortunately, the conditions beat us, and there was a big storm in the catchment, and the river, the creek basically turned into a river of black porridge, and the oxygen levels went to zero, and there was a major fish kill in that system.
But you were able to get a few out before that?
We got 10 out, and we've put them into one of our other populations, and hopefully the genetics from that population will mix with the other population, and then, you know, longer term, we're hoping to take that mix, those mixed genetics progeny from that population back to Manus Creek.
And these populations would mix on those spawning runs in the old days. They used to travel a long way. Is that good for hybrid vigour?
Absolutely, yeah. So what the geneticists are telling us with all of our Macquarie perch populations at the moment is that they're too small and they don't have enough genetic diversity to maintain those populations long term. So essentially what that means is they're all basically brothers and sisters or very close relatives breeding with each other, and they don't have enough genetic diversity to maintain those populations. So if we don't fix that genetics and we don't increase that genetic diversity, those populations will continue to decline. So we're taking fish from different populations and mixing them around and trying to add different genetics to those populations. And it's kind of like, a farmer would continue to bring in, stud bulls from different areas to increase, the genetics of his herd or increase that vigour in those populations.
Can we save them? We're speaking with Luke Pearce about this incredible scientific breakthrough for artificial breeding stimulating the fish to breed through synthesising a hormone. Incredible science by that Sunshine Coast University and for such a practical cause to save a fish. Because if you can breed them in the tens of thousands, all of a sudden all of the fisher folk will jump in as volunteer citizen scientists and help you with the stocking, as they've done with the Murray cod and all the other fish that were on the brink.
Yeah, for sure, Scott. And look, to answer your initial question, absolutely, I think we can bring this species back. And we've proven that. We've got a couple of instances where we've established new populations with the Retreat River project we've spoken about before. We've established a population there from captive fish. That population is now recruiting and they're breeding in that population there now.
We're speaking with fisheries scientist Luke Pearce from New South Wales DPI Fisheries. Luke, you're saying that they're looking to perfect this technique. How far off before we could see big numbers of these fish bred in the hatchery?
Yeah, look, I think within a couple of years, Scott, I really do. I think there's a few things we need to tweak around, particularly some of the early life stages. And Macquarie perch are particularly fragile in the egg and larval stage, and there's some techniques I think we need to perfect in that actual grow-out stage. But, I could easily see within, the next couple of years that those techniques would be very well refined, and then if resources were available that we could upscale and have some really increased production of this particular species to be, not just putting them back into the Macquarie River catchment, but, establishing populations, right across their former range and potentially, my dream and your dream down the track is that there's a recreational fishery again for this species, and we can go out and we can sight fish to these amazing fish in a crystal clear stream somewhere and put a dry fly over the top of it and watch it rise and then release it back into that stream again. It just be the ultimate.
How hardy are they? What sort of waters can they survive in?
They're particularly hardy. Historically, they occurred in the Murray River all the way down to Renmark in South Australia. So, they can handle some warm temperatures. They can handle cold temperatures. They were all the way from the top of the Murrumbidgee up above where Tangtangra Dam is these days, and up around Anaminaby and Cooma, all the way down the Murray to Renmark in South Australia. So they can handle, extremely wide, ranges in water temperature and water chemistry and all those things, and are particularly hardy. I think, there's huge potential in terms of, not just in streams and regulated rivers, but impoundments as well. They'll survive well in impoundments. Some of the largest populations we've got remaining are in impoundments, like Dartmouth Dam and Cataract Dam up near Wollongong.
Yeah.
And, I could see these, this particular species rivaling, golden perch as an impoundment fish, down the track. They all get almost as big as golden perch and very, very similar species in terms of, the size and depth of the fish, but different habits and different habitats. They'd be potentially, a great addition to some of those other golden perch fisheries as well.
And what sort of numbers can we produce Murray cod and golden perch and those other silver perch in the hatcheries with hormone inducement? What are we looking at if we get this right?
Oh, hundreds of thousands per year. Yeah, easily, you know, maybe up to 1 million fish a year, Scott. You know, it depends on, you know, what the, you know, availability of, you know, pond space and you know, resources are. But, you know, yeah, hundreds of thousands is certainly well within the, you know, within our reach, I think.
And the people of the Murray-Darling were crying out for those because they're so great to catch and release, and they're hardy and they live in all these, you know, their native conditions so well. They're so well adapted. Will it be the same for these? Will the fishing clubs and the pubs all along the mighty Murrumbidgee and the Murray and all these rivers, you know, will they have the same sort of joy, do you think, in stocking that they had bringing back the Murray cod?
Oh, absolutely, Scott. And the support and the drive from some of the recreational fishing groups around this species is really gaining momentum, you know, and they really want to, the groups that I'm working with really want to see this fish back. They have a real, you know, affinity with the fish and would love to see it one day back as a recreational species. Like, I guess the issue with Macquarie perch is that these things have been gone from the system for so long, or largely gone from the system. You know, they're gone from our collective memory. You know, most people don't know what a Macquarie perch is and don't know how abundant and how great they were from a recreational fish species. So I think we've got a lot of work to do from an education perspective and educate people about, you know, how abundant and widespread this species was and how great they were and how we can bring them back. And once we do that, I think we'll have, you know, a groundswell of support to bring this species back. And, you know, I guess you can't, you know, care for or want to bring back something that you don't know ever existed. So that's kind of the first step in the process. But, you know, where people do have a memory of it and do have an understanding of it, there's huge support to get this species back and bring it back more broadly.
You had me as soon as you said they rise like crazy, live in clear, cold, running water and take flies like there's no tomorrow and fight like would pull a trout backwards. You had me when you said that. Bring it on. Bring them back.
And were described by John Lake, who pioneered all of the captive breeding for some of those other native fish species, you remember, as the best freshwater table fish in Australia. So I'm not advocating that we should be eating them. But
no, not yet, because they're on the brink of extinction. But down the track when...
That were revered as a sport fish and a table fish as well.
Yeah, well, down the track when this technique is honed, as you're trying to do with this wonderful research crew at the Sunshine Coast University, when hundreds of thousands go in, maybe then we can have a strict bag limit of maybe one for the table or something, and people can try it. But that's a long way down the track, hopefully in our lifetime. Good luck to you. More strength to your arm, Luke Pearce. Thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott, and happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you too. There's a man fighting very hard to bring back a wonderful Australian native fish.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, and mighty fine for skipping stones. You'll feel fresh as a lemonade setting in the shade. Whether it's hot, whether it's cool, oh, what a spot for whistling like a fool. What a fine day to take a stroll and wander by the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day. We'll have no need to call the road when we get to the fishing hole. There'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to doodle time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to chaw and maybe set and jaw. Hanging around, taking our ease, watching that hound, a scratching at his flea. Come on, take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
It's on The Big Fish Show. troubled water. I went down to the river to pray. Wade in the water. My soul got happy and I stayed all day. The clouds gonna trouble the water.
Wade in the water.
Coming up on The Big Fish, we visit the longest beach in New South Wales for a fishing adventure with Stinker and the Shipwrecked Fisherman. We'll visit the Tin City in the Shifting Sands and paddle across shark-infested waters, dragging a big catch of fish behind us with Chris Simmons. All coming up on The Big Fish.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
G'day, Scott. How are you going?
I'm going well. We established last week that Stockton Beach is the longest beach on the New South Wales coastline. And what's happening down there?
Well, there's always something happening on Stockton Beach. Stockton Beach has got so much to offer. Apart from great surfing, for those that have got surfboards, it's a good surf club. The Berube Surf Club is a cracker. Interestingly enough, it's one of the greatest aggregation sites of great white sharks on the east coast. And the irony of it is, but it's only a kilometre or two from the surf club. Now, I've been along that beach behind the waves in a boat with some mullet in a box and a bit of rope. Now, what I did, I tied the mullet to the rope and threw it out into the water, and the great whites, I had Georgie Trinkler with me. It's always good to have a witness with you, otherwise these stories seem a bit hard to believe. But George and I went down there, and what we did, we threw these mullet into the water, and the great whites come from behind the breakers, not big fish, oh, 2 or 3 metre fish, but whacko, and we got some photos. These things come straight to the surface and charge at the mullet. And once we had one on the mullet, then you start pulling on the rope. There's no hook. There was no hook. We weren't trying to hook them. We were just sort of trying to figure out how many were there. Well, one of the spotters, now I mentioned the job of a spotter before. Now, he works with the mullet crew, and he finds a vantage point that's the highest point so he can see the schools of mullet coming along the coast. Now, I've spoken to a few spotters about these great white sharks, and one day they reckon they counted 18 great whites on his smalls. Now, there's some...
That's not small, 2 to 3 metres, even though they're babies. It's still big.
Well, every great white's big. That's right.
They're born about a metre long.
That's right. They're born big. That's true. So, I mean, this is all on Stockton Beach. And to my knowledge, there has never, ever been a fatal attack. Now, interesting, while we're talking about sharks, I'm also asked on many occasions what's my opinion of drum lines and set nets. Now, Port Stephens has never had a drum line or a set net, to my knowledge, and that would be over 150 years. Of Port Stephens, they've never ever had anything to protect swimmers from sharks, any sort of shark. And I can't recall a fatality. There have been some attacks here, one particularly severe one inside the harbour. A young lady was attacked, and that was a horrible incident. But as far as fatalities are concerned, no. Now, we also get a very high number of people that swim here and surf and do everything. It's a beautiful place to come, Port Stephens, and we've never had a problem. So why we would need a net or a drum line, no way. I can't see any sense in it. I don't think, even the ones that are set now along our coastline and into Queensland, I don't think they're worth two bob anyway. Really, they're more of a political statement than a useful tool.
What else is on the beach?
It's not only mullet. I mean, there have been the mullet fishermen have been on Fingal Beach this week. And anyone that would like to come for holidays to Port Stephens over Easter, come and have a look at the mullet fishermen at work. It's a real education. Bring the kids. It's nature at work, and it's a sustainable industry. So if you don't fear for the mullet. The mullet are well and truly doing extremely well. But to answer your question as to what else is on the beach, I have had reports, and the water's still murky from all the floodwaters we've had, and to a degree fresher than normal, but the brim have really piled onto the beach as well. And from Stockton Beach to One Mile Beach to Boat Harbour to Fingal, they're catching some beautiful brim, really broad-shouldered, bright-eyed brim that have come out of the estuaries as well. And these fish are really good eating, beautiful, beautiful eating fish. But not only brim either. I mean, the mulloway are there. If there's mullet, there's mulloway. And, of course, the grey nurse sharks are in attendance as well. You know, when events like this occur and we see nature in all its beauty, you can really start to assess where we're moving in this whole business. Oh, golly, look, I must write a history of Stockton Beach because it really is. It's an iconic beach. And I didn't know until you said last week that it was the biggest beach in New South Wales. I didn't know that. But everybody needs to drive on or walk on Stockton Beach because, and the Aboriginal people are very involved there too. There's a lot of relics and memorabilia and, you know, everything for the Aboriginal people. And they've claimed, I think, 19 kilometres of that beach for Worimi people, and so they should. And that's very sacred to them. And it's of great cultural significance.
And Stinker, also the funny little population in the Drifting Sands, the Tin Town, which is the most tin city. Yeah. It's an amazing place, isn't it? It's like something out of Mad Max. I think they might have filmed some Mad Max there.
They may well have. And Tin City, it's well known. And it's built. There's 11 houses last time I counted. I mean, they're shanties. They're tin shanties, but they've got TV in there. But you use a lot of shovels there and not many motor mowers. There's no grass.
It's just sand. Drifting sand too, isn't it? You know?
And you've got to have a dozer there, a bulldozer, to shift the sand. You can't just shift it with a shovel. When the sand starts to move, you need a bulldozer. So they've got one of them. But if you Google Tin City, Stockton Beach, you'll get the shock of your life. It's remarkable what happens there. But there's something else I meant to mention about Stockton Beach, and that it was considered to be a site for an invasion during Second World War. So there are a lot of tank traps there. And also it was used to explode bombs and do bomb practice. And so there are still a few unexploded bombs up there. So if it looks like a bomb on Stockton Beach, it is a bomb.
And the sand dunes are amazing, aren't they? They're huge sand dunes. You'd swear to goodness you're in the Sahara or something.
I flew over there once when the sun was going down, and it looked like there was just kilometre after kilometre of these massive sand dunes, and it looked like gold dust. It struck me as there's gold dust. It was just the most amazing place. And Bert Hinkler, we all know about Bert Hinkler and his exploits in the plane. He's a famous pilot, of course. Well, he landed on Stockton Beach and the wind flipped his plane over. So he had to go and get a few horses from one of the farmers up there to turn his plane up the right side up, and then he was okay. Everything was okay. So there's story after story about Stockton Beach. And of course the Cigna.
Cigna? Look, what about that brilliant bloke you put us on to, Chris Simmons, who wrote his memories of fishing and camping on the wreck?
That ship run aground in 1974. Now you could put it in a bucket. You could put the whole ship in a bucket. It's gone. There's no sign of it. Stockton Beach has got a lot to offer, hasn't it?
It has a marvellous, amazing place, and one of those rare beaches where you can actually drive along it, but the road, the rules of the road do apply. You need a permit.
Yep, that's right. And you get that from the council, the Port Stephens Council, and you can get a permit. And you can't take pippies off the beach, so don't try that, because the people who walk the beach regularly now have become voluntary rangers, and if they see you putting pippies in a bucket, you're allowed to use them to catch fish, but you're not allowed to take them off the beach. So if you think you're going to go down there and start pilfering or be a pippy pirate, well, you'll get another thing coming, because no, you cannot do that. Every pippy must remain on the beach or below high tide level.
And John, it was a big fight, wasn't it, when the over-harvest really decimated their numbers. Have they bounced back?
Yes, it is. It's you have the bigger seasons and they come and go to a degree. But when I was most concerned, they'd pretty much gone altogether. There was only 5% of the population of pippies on the beach, which was a major concern. And when we looked closely at it and tried to figure out why that these numbers had collapsed, there were a couple of reasons. One was that commercial fishermen, pippy harvesters, had no rules and regulations at all. Nil, zilch. You've got to have some rules for natural resources. You just cannot take natural resources away open slather. That's just not on. So Fisheries have organised that, so that's under control. But also the taking of pippies by pirates from the south was a real issue too. I mean, buses would turn up on Stockton Beach, unmarked buses, and then people would disembark, walk down the beach. One bloke had a baby in a pram. He took the baby out and filled the pram full of pippies. I mean, this is no good. You know, this had to stop. And so there's far more vigilance on Stockton Beach as far as we've taken some control of the pippy situation. And yes, it's a more stable population now than it has been. But I mean, just think, that's not long ago, Scott, that it was open slather on pippies, and that's dreadful. In any society, you cannot have open slather on a natural resource. It's got to be controlled.
Oh, it was a sheer bloody greed, wasn't it? That almost
it was. That's what it boils down.
Wiped them out. Anyway, the good news is there's better protection now. Still got to be vigilant, yep, though. We've all got to be vigilant, Stinker. Hey, tight lines, mate. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on mighty Stockton Beach, the biggest beach, the longest beach on our coastline in New South Wales.
Hey, you're welcome, Scott.
Hooroo.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
But as Stinker was saying, there was an amazing fishing platform there that only a few adventurous, brave, some would say foolhardy fisher folk dared to venture onto. It was the Cygnus, the wreck of the Cygnus, and the shipwrecked fisherman, Chris Simmons, spoke to us when he released the book about his adventures on the Cygnus. An amazing story. And when Stinker was talking about Stockton Beach, it made me think about Chris and his mates who had this awesome fishing adventure on that old boat. I heard about you from a mutual mate, Stinker, who's a regular on the program. And gee whiz, what a book. I guess you couldn't really write it until it was gone, because you really didn't want people doing what you'd been doing.
No, you've got to try and keep the numbers down.
Yeah, but also safety-wise. I mean, tell us about the logistics of clambering onto this giant rotting hulk off Stockton Beach there.
Well, we'd have to drive up the beach, unpack the car. Then we'd have rope coming off a board, one to a bucket, one to your ankle, and one to a bunch of rods, and then paddle out to the wreck and have a grappling hook and throw that up, and then climb up that and pull all the gear up and then help the mates up, and then rig all your gear up and start fishing. It was fantastic.
What was inside?
Pretty hard work.
What was inside? What was it like inside the wreck?
Oh, it was whatever your imagination could let you do. It was dark in some places. It was spooky at night. Nighttime was fantastic out there. Just to be there was good, let alone catching fish.
Were there any animals in it?
Only us. Only us and fish and loads of crabs. Crabs and everything. It was its own little reef.
Did you wake up with crabs crawling over you?
Yeah, I did, yes. One morning. Because I wiped my hands all over my tummy and overnight, and I woke up and could hear this bubbling sound, and I looked down and here's these crabs looking at me and eating all the bits of fish off my belly. They were on the wetsuit, yeah. That was the first night I was ever out there. That was great.
Wow. Yeah. Just describe it for people who'd never seen what it was like, because it was the back half, so it had the cabins, didn't it? The crew cabins, the captain's cabin, and the big funnel. And what did you set up inside? What was your camp like? Did you have cooking and all that, or no?
No. There would have been too much gear to bring out. There was some wood there once. In the wintertime, it was freezing cold. It was really cold, with some of the westerlies blowing. And we tried to get a fire going in there a few times. There was some wood left on board, but it was soaked in oil and salt. And every time you light it, it'd just smoke you out of the place. So we gave that one a miss. Yeah, so we got good at eating cold pies.
Tell us the story of George's Dewey.
That was a great night. That was we'd caught a few baits. Well, you could call them baits. They were only pennies and little rock cods and things. We couldn't catch a yellowtail or anything, you know, substantial for a jewfish bait. So anyway, we put a couple out and there was nothing, and it came dark. And one of the mates was looking on the side of the wreck and he said, there's a school of mullet next to the wreck. So we tied a fishing scoop net to a pole we had, and he scooped one. So I threw it out. And within 10 minutes, I had a great deal. And then he got another one, and then George got one. And they were both the same size. And anyway, we had a rowboat at the time because there was too many sharks out there on the boards. We just getting spooked out. So we had this old rowboat. And we're coming back the next morning, and I said to the boys, you think we should tie everything up into the boat? No, it'll be right. And, of course, as we're coming back in, we got rolled over into the surf. Everything went everywhere. It was all up the beach everywhere. And I felt a thing scrape my leg in the water, so I grabbed it. It was a big hessian bag with one of the jewies in it. We got up to the beach, and George had lost his gear, his glasses and everything. He said, all right, whose fish is it? And I'd already cut the corner of a tail off mine, so we knew which one was which, and it was mine. Poor bloke, he lost it all and his jewie, but we had the camera there that night. And but his very next trip, he hit one on the head. He didn't even have his reel turned to wind his slack line in, and it was taking off. So he made up for it.
We're speaking with a shipwrecked fisherman, Chris Simmons, whose book, The Sigma, My Story, is the most fantastic adventure fishing book I've ever read. And amazing tales of living on this rotting hulk and catching monstrous fish, the jewfish particularly. Got so many great jewfish, everything really. But the sharks are so prolific there. It's the great white breeding area. Tell us some of the shark stories. There are plenty of them. I believe one of the beach fishermen was trying to get a message to you once when you were paddling out on the surfboards.
Yeah, we paddled out through the break, and a mate of mine was camping on the beach that night because he wouldn't go out. He didn't like sharks, I think. But yeah, that made the numbers better for us too out there. But we went out and we fished all night, and we came back in the next day, and he was still there, and he had a big go at me. He said, are you blind and you deaf? He said, mate, we were yelling out, we were screaming, we were beeping the horns in the car. You guys just kept paddling. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, there was a huge shark just cruising behind you guys when you were paddling out. I said, oh, well, I'm glad I didn't now, because that would have been worse, trying to get up under the wreck.
So it's really stalking you.
Well, that's what he said. It was just zigzagging behind us.
It'd be a great white, wouldn't it?
Oh, I don't care what it was. They've all got teeth, mate. there's lots of all types. We've got hammerheads, bronze whalers. It was pretty full on.
Did you lose fish to them and hook them?
Oh, yeah, we used to hook up and not be able to stop them. Because back then we just had old sidecasts, old Elvies. And once you got a lump of that, those things going, you just either had to break off or hope for the best. We got a few sharks in, but we just cut them off and let them go.
And you often caught giant ludwig, massive ludwig, down in the sort of hold of the ship, didn't you?
Yeah, that's where the brim were and the smaller jewies. So back then you were allowed to keep much smaller jewies. But it was like a honey hole. And I used to live across the road from this old guy. It's me, I'm old now, but anyway, he used to say, there's got to be ludwig out there. There's got to be millions of them, because there's weed growing on the deck and everything, and the water would wash across the weed. And one day we couldn't get a brim. We couldn't get a bite. So we just went for a walk, and we looked down from the superstructure, and I could see these flashes in the white water in the cargo hold. And so, look at the brim. So we've raced down there, throw some baits out. Not a bite, not a touch. And then a wave came over, and I saw all of these big bronze beauties. I went, oh, that ludwig. We didn't have any gear, no floats and anything. It was too rough to use a float, so we thought, I'll just put a hook on the end of the line, wrap a bit of cabbage around it, which grew all over the deck, and flick it out. So we just loosened it off with our boots, and every time a wave would come, it would wash it in. Oh, it was just like, this is unbelievable. And they were all good fish. They were all clean, big fish. We never got any small stuff or anything there.
Here's a chapter called Lighting, and there's a picture of Neville Sternbeck, your mate, on the deck with giant jewfish and brim and tailor One afternoon, Mick, Neville, George and I had caught a dozen baits. Rig ready to go, we looked west and the sky had turned black. Thunderstorm coming. Is it advisable to be fishing on a shipwreck in an electrical storm? Someone said. Oh, let's just fish for a while and see, was the reply. Out go four baits. Bang, Neb was on. Bang, bang, bang. We're all on. Cross lines and big fish everywhere. Absolutely brilliant. And then you ran for cover because I think it would conduct electricity, wouldn't it, if it got hit?
Yeah. Yep.
And now she's gone. The sea giveth, as you write, and then the sea taketh away.
Yeah. And it was always going to be a story that had to be told. But everybody thought, oh, someone else will tell it. So John Clark was the one who pushed the responsibility onto me after I showed him the photos. Mm. So I thought, okay, let's have a go.
It would have been interesting bringing some of those big hauls of fish back. As you say, you swamped the dinghy. And looking at the cover picture, you've got giant old mouths on top of the four-wheel drive that you used to get you out there. That would have been a bit precarious with fish trailing blood paddling across the gutter full of great white sharks back to the beach.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're trying not to think about the negatives too much. But, yeah, we used to take a heap of milk bottles, the 2-litre milk bottles with us, and we just try and float them and tie that to them and then drag them back behind the boards. Sometimes we had to put a rope between our teeth if you had two, and we just have one either side of us while we paddled in. And, yeah, we were floating burley bottles, really.
It's just a great yarn. The story of the shipwrecked fisherman, Chris Simmons, and his mates, who had many, many years of adventure on the wreck of the Cigna, the bulk carrier that washed up on Stockton Beach, or the back half that washed up. And you do a bit of the history of the ship as well. Chris, it's a great yarn. It really is well done for documenting it.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thank you.
If you have a fishy photo or two or a story to share, or would like to ask an expert, you can drop us a line, thebigfish@your.abc.net.au, and you can visit our Facebook page. And don't forget to subscribe to the Big Fish podcast on the ABC Listen app or however you catch your podcasts. Tight lines, we'll catch you next time on The Big Fish.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.